Hi, I'm Adam Chilper with Microsoft, and I'm excited, super excited to be here today at the Women in Data Bootcamp for the NASA Space App Challenge. And I think, I don't know that I've ever been more excited to interview someone, because as you can tell from the outfit, I am here with a real live astronaut, Doug Wheelock, aka Wheels.
Wheels.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? And I'm dying to know how did you become an astronaut?
Well, I'm an ordinary kid from an ordinary place, and that's how the magic happens at NASA. But I grew up in a small town in upstate New York, and a very, very small town. It's not usually on the maps. When to find it from space, I had to look down and see the Finger Lakes in New York and kind of triangulate to where my hometown is. But a very small town, very small school. And I was in elementary school when we put people on the moon. So I saw people walking around on the moon. And I remember our teachers telling us, like, you could do that one day too. And I thought, you're crazy. You know, and I think our kids today get that way as well, because we sort of have this, we've pigeonholed ourselves into, like, well, that's that kind of thing is reserved for extraordinary people, you know, can't be for ordinary people like me. And the reality is, one of the cool things, when I first got to NASA, in 1998, I got a chance to meet Neil Armstrong.
Oh, wow.
And so when I was talking to him, you know, I was like, what do I say to Neil Armstrong, right. You know, this ordinary kid from, and he goes, well, you know, I'm from Wapakoneta, Ohio. Nobody's ever heard of that place. I was just an ordinary kid from an ordinary place. I said, wait, that's my story. And the reality is, that's all of our stories. I mean, that's the magic of just the excitement of space exploration, is that we're it's just taking ordinary people, ordinary kids with extraordinary dreams, and that take the time to prepare themselves and be ready for the opportunity to cross their path.
So. What made you go down that path?
So in the early days, though, the early astronauts were test pilots. So I thought, that's what I'm going to be a test pilot so I can be an astronaut. And so I went to West Point. So I went to a military academy and then went to flight school, and I said, I'm going to be a test pilot one day. And so that was my goal. And I ended up loving it anyway, but I sort of did things backwards of what I tell kids now. Is what I tell them now is, like, find something you love to do.
Yeah.
It's like, I thought I was going to love to fly, but I had never flown before. And so I remember getting the flight school and I first learned on helicopters, and I got in that seat and I was like, I hope I like flying, because here I am, you know, in flight school. And so what I tell kids now is, like, don't stand your future on its head like I did. You know, it's like, think of something you love to do. And if it's in the area of the STEM subjects, you know, the science, technology, engineering, and math, if your passion lies there, it's what you want to do for a profession lies there, or even school and things, just chase after that, what you love to do. Because when you're doing something you love, you know, you don't never have to go to work another day in your life, you know. So
does it ever, I'm sure, I mean, being an astronaut, I imagine, is a very tough business at times. And other times, do you imagine, like, wow, this is, I'm getting paid to do this. I'm in space.
Yes, it's funny. Yes, exactly. But, you know, I've been an astronaut for 18 years, and I've been in space for 178 days.
Wow.
So you really have to find that balance, and I have to be doing something that I love to do, that I have a passion for. So that's another reason why it's so important, especially for young people that want this as a dream. You may be an astronaut for 20 years and fly in space for 6 months of that, you know. So if you don't love what you're doing, you know, outside that. And so we at NASA, I just love the creativity in NASA, and it nurtures, like, original thought and just crazy ideas, you know, and just, like, tell me your ideas. And so it's an environment where we know that innovation in one field eventually becomes revolutionary in another field. And so we look at our young engineers that way, and we look at the problems we face that way as well.
So. Wow. So you mentioned STEM and those particular roles in NASA you were talking about earlier. And, you know, you need people that are doctors, for example, and that can do medical things. I asked you a question about what happens if you get sick in space. And
yes.
You'd said there's a pharmacy. Right?
So we have, like, a little locker that's essentially a pharmacy, and we have a range of medical supplies in there. And, of course, we have doctors on the ground that we're always talking to and consulting with and everything. And so if we have an injury or someone's sick or not feeling well or something, so we'll will call the doc on a private call and they say like, okay, go to the locker, go to drawer D and look in pouch number 5 and in there you're going to find, a decongestant or, what have you, and take one of those and call me in the morning, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's pretty much like that. We do use a lot of telemedicine, but we also have, on every mission that we fly, we have a chief medical officer. And if we don't have an MD on that mission, they take one of us, and for my mission, they put me through training, medical training. I knew enough to suture. I knew enough to do an emergency appendectomy.
Wow.
And I was trained. I spent 3 weeks in a trauma center in Houston doing suturing and intubating and catheters. And so I had to get trained on all this. Of course, I told my crewmates, I was like, make sure you don't get sick because I don't know if you want me as your doctor. So, but it's enough to where we can get somebody stabilized and we can get them back home, in a relatively short order.
And you didn't have to use that at all.
We did not have to use that. I was very grateful, and my crewmates were grateful as well.
So. You mentioned injury. What kind of injuries might somebody be an astronaut?
Yeah, so you're thinking like everything's floating around in space. How could you possibly get injured in space? And so one of the easy ways to get injured is we have, between each module, the space station is built like a big habit trail. So we've got all these modules kind of plugged together and going off in different branches. And between each module, we can isolate each module in case there's some sort of pressure breach or something. And so the end of each module has a big metal hatch and it seals off and latches down. And when it's open, it kind of lays on its side against the hull of the ship. And of course, one of our favorite astronaut tricks in space is to fly through the space station like Superman.
It just draws you to do that.
That's right. So if you get overzealous, Superman can reach a not so noble end. When you run into a metal hatch, or you can even, as you're making a turn or something, you can even catch your hand behind some sort of metal protrusion or something. So we occasionally get small lacerations and bruises and things like that from running into metal hatches.
Oh, so, my goodness. So. But that's got to be cool, though. I mean, is a feeling of that amazing? You're up there and you're just propelling yourself.
It really is. It's the feeling of floating is euphoric. I mean, it really, for me, it was just... And it never got old for me. I'd have video conferences with my family or something with my mom and dad. I'd be like, hey, you want to see my Spider-Man? I'd be on all fours on the floor, and then I'd push off and grab onto the ceiling. And
that's pretty cool.
So it's pretty neat. But everything's floating, so which is two-edged sword, So everything, you're floating around, so you feel like you're Superman. But your tools are floating, your food is floating, whatever you... your drink bag is floating. When we have a potty, there's some things we don't want floating, things like that. So we have to engineer, and we wear a lot of Velcro up there. We have all of our tools are covered with Velcro. Our food bags with Velcro as well. Yes, we strap everything down, and so it's a really fun environment to float around in. But that when you come back to Earth, probably one of the hardest things to adapt to. They don't let us drive for a couple of months, which is a very good thing because I thought, what's the problem with driving or even going out and running on the sidewalk or something? It's because for 6 months, everything is floating around, everything inside the space. Even when you look out the window, you're orbiting pretty fast, but the Earth just sort of is moving in your field like this. So it's almost like it's floating as well. And so when you get back and now not everything is floating, nothing is floating. And so now your essentially closure and opening rates can be very deceiving. If you're driving a car and you see another car coming your way, it's not floating now,
and
so your brain is a little confused and your reactions are way off, and so they don't allow us to drive or ride a bike for several weeks after we get back.
Now I noticed one of the patches that you have is, I believe it's the Mach 25.
Mach 25 in a Soyuz and Mach 25 in a space shuttle.
Yep. Wow.
25 times the speed of sound, orbital velocity.
That is crazy. Do you feel like you're going that fast? I mean, I guess it's once you're up the speed, things...
Once you get to space, the sensation of speed is not so great. When you're falling to the Earth, it's alarming. So I remember coming in over, I came back on the space shuttle first back in 2007. And we came in a descending node into Florida. So we were landing in Florida. We entered U.S. airspace around Seattle, Vancouver area. And we made a banking turn. I could see Seattle right there and Vancouver. And then 19 minutes later, we were landing in Florida.
Wow.
So it's pretty eye-watering, the reentry. And so you're falling to Earth, and you can see the Earth getting bigger. You know, it's visually, the Earth is.
Is there a lot of noise? Like in the movies, you hear this rumble as kind of your
reentry. In the space shuttle, is relatively quiet, but there's a little bit of a rattle of the things inside, kind of bouncing around. Coming back in a Soyuz capsule, which I came back in 2010, and we land on land in Kazakhstan. And it's a little capsule that burns through the atmosphere. Wow. It's like going over Niagara Falls in a barrel, and the barrel's on fire, you know, sort of thing. So it's rough, it's loud, it's bumpy, you're spinning, it's hot, and it's a little alarming. I remember my Russian commander was sitting, I had a window seat, so I'm looking out the window and watching the bits of our spaceship burning up that aren't supposed to get, and we're in the safe zone, so the parts that we shed are burning up outside our window. And so I would say, I'd be, you know, pointing, he goes, this is normal, you know. So then you hear a loud bang, you know, and I knew we had an event where pyrotechnics would blow and then the modules would separate, and I'd look out at all this metal kind of shards flying off into space, and he goes, this is normal. When I was getting ready to come back home in the Soyuz, I sent some email to some friends on Earth that had ridden the Soyuz back, and I said, "Tell me what to expect." And it's like a series. Yes, they described it as a series of loud explosions followed by a really bad car crash, and that's about what it was. So
you were talking about the liquids. You know, everything really has to be attached in space. Did you ever spill anything in space?
You can get things can get very messy. Now, liquids in space behave strangely. Like we've seen these films with like balls of water and all sorts
kind of
fluids.
Like
it's like, it really is like slime on like Nickelodeon or something, you know, where if you put your hand in that, it sort of sticks to you like slime. So you can't just pull your hand back out of a ball of water. It just, the surface tension is so
crazy.
High that it just
wow.
like engulfs your hand. And it's like having slime on your hand or something, you know. So you have to be really careful. Of course, if a ball of water, it'll grow into a ball if there's a leak, and it'll just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And if there's electrical connectors nearby and things, and it gets engulfed in this ball of water, you have the same danger as combining water. And I used to tell the kids, it's like, they don't like each other. It's actually, they like each other too much. You know, so you don't want to combine that, like a ball of fluid with an electrical connector.
Like if you happen to sneeze or that happens, how does that get cleaned up? Is it just constant, like an air filtration that pulls out?
Yeah,
the
we have HEPA filters on board that really filter the air down to fine micron level. And so we do have those filters on board every Saturday is cleaning day. So everybody, we vacuum all the filters. We have a vacuum cleaner on board, which is fun to take vacuum cleaner rides. You think about it, you can actually ride a vacuum cleaner in space, which is awesome. But we vacuum the filters to keep those clean or to clean those out. And we also disinfect all the panels and the lab in the space station. So the space station actually smells very sterile. You know, it smells like a laboratory. You know, you can hear the hum of, we have 80, when I was there, we had 87 laptop computers, you know, running and, you know, in their own particular experiments. Some of them are running the space station command. You can send commands and things like that.
What's this button
but do? don't touch the big red button. But it sounds like a laboratory. It smells very sterile. It's kind of like the kids are like, what does it smell like? It's like, you know, if you have your TV running or your computer running, kind of stick your nose down by the exhaust of it, and it smells like kind of warm
ozone-y
plastic or something.
Kind of
warm plastic, ozone-y, so something like that. So the things I missed so much were just like the smell of like grass and trees and dirt and oranges and you know, all the things that I didn't really crave any food. I craved scent, like scent and sounds. Like I, there's like just the sound of equipment running. So I missed like the sound of rain and the sound of birds singing and stuff like that. It's just
things you hear all
of it,
daily.
All of it's absent up there in space, and it you notice it, but it's you're still novelty of being in space.
Yeah.
Then after a few weeks, even, and you're there for 6 months or a year in some cases, and you really begin to miss these the sights and sounds of Earth.
Do you find yourself kind of daydreaming about these smells
yes.
or things at times?
Yes, I do. In fact, we were talking to some of the great innovators that are here today, and one of the gentlemen talking to me is like, how can we take those smells? Surely there's got to be a way where we can take those smells and have a pantry of smells, you know? It's like, you know, I miss home, you know? I think, you know, Adam's from Seattle or whatever. He probably misses the rain. So let's open this little bottle and there's a smell of the forest and after the rain or something like that, you know? And it's like psychologically, it really has a huge impact on you. And especially if we're going to send people out to Mars and not expect them to come back for two or three years.
Question. How are we going
to
handle that?
Yeah, it's
so
a
long.
Huge psychological challenge for us to people that miss, you know, maybe you can can sounds of a, you know, that we have these, you know, DVDs or CDs you can buy where, you know, it's the sound of the rain or a thunderstorm or something like that, you know, so
yeah.
That like therapy in that area, I think is a real open field right now.
Sure.
I don't think we have much of that on board the station now, and I don't know if there's people looking at that for support for the
I wonder going forward where like the field of AR and VR is going to take place. Imagine putting on a headset and being reminded of your hometown or being able to look around and feel.
Yes. I imagine running on the treadmill and having your old trail that used to run through the woods or something, you know. We talked about that as well. So we have a very, very vibrant virtual reality laboratory in Houston that helps us. But right now, their main focus right now is helping us on spacewalks to really generate the feel of what it's like outside, and they can replicate. You know, there's some things they can't do, but they can. We actually have a. We call it Charlotte, because it looks like Charlotte's Web. We have these masses that. It's just a piece of metal with some handles, but we have all these wires going. It's suspended. And we can replicate the mass and the mass distribution of a particular object, so we can hold onto it in virtual reality, and we can move it around, and it'll feel just like it feels like in space, maneuvering
wow.
Like a big refrigerator with one hand or something.
Have you ever? I'm sorry.
No. I was going to say everything is weightless in space, but F still equals ma in space. You know, so we still have to really be concerned with mass and how much we accelerate that mass, what kind of force we impart on a mass, because we have to decelerate that same amount of force
right.
as well. So,
have you ever had to say, Houston, we have a problem?
Yeah, well, I didn't quite say it like that, but as the alarms went off one night and we had the space station. The space station's pretty smart. I wouldn't say it's brilliant, but it does have a mode that it goes, if it senses something. I talked a little bit to the folks today. The big three for us are fire, toxic atmosphere release into the atmosphere, and decompression. So if we had, like the movie Gravity, if you have something impact the station and breach the hull or something, because outside of that thing is pure vacuum, and so we can't survive out there. So we look at those three big things, and when the alarms go off, you kind of go primal, you know, at that point, and dealing with problems that arise on the station. But we certainly have a protocol that we step through when we're dealing with issues on the station.
It's interesting when you say you go primal. I had asked you, I think, earlier before the interview about what happens. Are there ever times that you have to rely on that impulse? Like, from our standpoint, we see in the movies, it seems everything so regimented through NASA. Are there times where really you have to do these last quick-minute decisions and last-minute decisions? And
Well, that was something that NASA, it's a wonderful skill to have. It's a skill you can actually develop in people as well, where there are some things, some skills that you can teach someone. It's difficult to teach someone leadership and things like that, you know, so it's more difficult. It's easier to teach someone a science experiment than it is to teach them how to balance impulse and logic in a problem, in a situation where a major failure, or, you know, being able to look at a situation and triage it, you know, and that, like an engineer or a problem solver or an innovator would do. It's like, you know, so they teach us, it's like, am I on fire? I'm not on fire. Are my ears popping? Can I breathe? Okay, I've got time, you know, so I don't have to make a impulsive decision. But we also err on the side of safety of the vehicle and the crew, of course. And so we're also trained to, if you don't know, then act impulsively to correct the situation or get in a safe configuration. So then if you look back, you have time to look back and say, like, I should have been a little more analytical on that, and I probably made the wrong decision. But because it was not a decision that needed an impulsive decision, we can back out of what we did over here, and we can think of it more now analytically, like look at the different courses of action and pros and cons of each. And so there is a fine balance that we love to have at NASA. That's why the original astronauts were test pilots, because test pilots are taught that in an aircraft that's plummeting toward the Earth, you know. Yes. So taught how to manage a fine balance between logic and impulse, and it's a very important skill to have. And you can develop it, and you can have it developed for you, you know, in a crisis situation as well. Sometimes those dictate what you learn, how quickly you learn as well.
So. Interesting. Any advice for the next generation coming forward? You came from a small town.
Yeah. So advice? I think my first bit of advice is, all these things we see in the human experience, people flying airplanes, people looking for cures for cancer in a laboratory somewhere, doctors that fix broken parts, people that walk on the moon, you know, people that build rockets, all these things are part of the human experience. Yeah. And because they're part of the human experience and we're human, they're all accessible to us, you know, and to our kids and to any student person out there. I mean, it's all available to us. And I think we think that, well, that kind of thing is reserved for somebody extraordinary or with extraordinary skills or from some extraordinary place. And the reality is we're all from ordinary places and we're ordinary kids, you know? And when people finally realize that, it's like, so the key is preparation, you know, prepare, educate yourself, learn, always be curious, always ask questions. So those are the first three things I tell when I'm talking to students, always be curious.
Be curious.
Don't stop asking questions. Always be curious, and just prepare yourself. Find something you love to do and prepare yourself, because people like Neil Armstrong, he just prepared himself, and then when that extraordinary opportunity crosses his path, he's ready.
He's ready.
And chance favors the prepared mind. I mean, it's a big,
sure.
I mean, when I first started learning to fly, my first flight instructor told me, I was just trying to, I had a handful of airplane and, you know, and a bundle of nerves, and he said, you know, that chance favors the prepared mind. It's like, what are you quoting poetry to me, or is that, you know? He goes, you know, actually Louis Pasteur said that. He said, chance favors the prepared mind. So, when the engine quits, where are you going to go? You should always be thinking about that. When the engine quits, where are you going to go? And I'm thinking, like, I'm just trying to learn how to fly, and he kept drilling this into me every day. He's over there, he's sitting beside me in a helicopter, and he said, you know, chance favors the prepared mind.
Yeah.
So if the mind's prepared, when the engine quits, where are you going to go? And then about 2 weeks into flight school, he said, you know, the chance favors the prepared mind, and he killed the engine.
Oh, wow.
In a real airplane, you know, a helicopter in this case. And I had an out-of-body experience where I just like mechanically did what I was taught, and we were safely on the ground. And I looked over at him, and my heart just like this, you know. And he said, I told you that chance favors the prepared mind. So when opportunity crosses your path, that's the person that makes it through when you're prepared. So
excellent, excellent advice. Chance favors the prepared mind.
That's right.
Doug, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
You're an inspiration.
Thank you.
I can't wait to see what you have in store for your future adventures and what the next generation has in store, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Adam.